This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we mark the 35th anniversary of the mass slaughter of civilian Palestinians by Lebanese fascists in their refugee camps of Sabra and Shatila.
The role and responsibility of Israel in this is well known, but what's not so well known is the role of the United States.
We'll talk about an innovative new initiative to help register more people to vote.
The struggle for voting rights has gone on in the United States ever since the American Revolution. It was extended the right to vote to women in the 1920s. It was finally secured for black people in the 1960s. Nevertheless, voting turnout in the United States is quite low. It's important. Give a listen to how this could be changed.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
This month marks the 35th anniversary of the mass slaughter of civilian Palestinians by Lebanese fascists in their Lebanon refugee camps of Sabra and Shatila. The Palestinians who lived in the camps had been driven out of their villages in the Galilee by Israel. They had lived there for hundreds of years until the Zionist colonialists expelled them in 1948. The Israeli army aided in the 1982 slaughter. The 1982 Israeli invasion of Lebanon, which preceded the massacre, was given the green light by Washington. Up to 1982, the Palestine Liberation Organization, known as the PLO, had its headquarters in Beirut, Lebanon. The Israeli army invaded Lebanon and succeeded in driving the PLO out. The United States gave written commitments to the PLO about protecting the civilian population in order to secure the PLO's evacuation from Beirut the month before the slaughter at Sabra and Shatila camps. Israel Defense Minister Ariel Sharon falsely asserted that there were 2,000 terrorists in the camps. U.S. Envoy to Lebanon Maurice Draper did not dispute this falsehood. Sharon told Draper that, quote, "We will kill them. They will not be left here. You are not going to save them," end quote. Sharon sent Lebanese fascists into the refugee camps. They silently killed hundreds of Palestinians and Lebanese, mostly women and children and old men, using knives and bayonets. The Israeli army lit up the killing fields with flares and had soldiers present. There was such a worldwide outcry that Israel was forced to set up a commission of inquiry. That commission found that Sharon bore, quote, "personal responsibility," end quote, for the massacre and recommended that he be dismissed from his post as defense minister. The blowback from these events in Lebanon 35 years ago still echo today in the wars America is conducting in Syria and Iraq and possibly Iran. Here to speak with us is Rashid Khalidi. He is the Edward Said Professor of Arab Studies at Columbia University. He is the author of Under Siege, PLO Decision-Making During the 1982 War, and most recently, Brokers of Deceit, How the U.S. Has Undermined Peace in the Middle East. Professor Khalidi recently had an article on the Sabra and Shatila massacre in The Nation magazine. Rashid Khalidi, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Rashid, you wrote in your recent Nation article that the U.S. was responsible for the 1982 massacre of Palestinians in Beirut. But before we get into that question of why you believe this to be true, could you please tell us why the Palestinians were in Beirut, Lebanon, in the first place, where'd they come from, and why'd they leave?
Most of the Palestinians in Lebanon are refugees, or the descendants of refugees, who were driven out of what is now northern Israel in 1948 and have been there ever since. Some of the people in 1982 were also Palestinians in the PLO who had been driven out of Jordan in 1970 after Black September. So the Palestinian political and military leadership were in Lebanon, but the bulk of the population were refugees from 1948.
The prestigious Israeli newspaper Haaretz reported that the Israeli army invaded Lebanon in 1982 because they had a long-term objective aimed at the expulsion of the whole Palestinian population of Lebanon, beginning with Beirut. The purpose was to create a panic to convince all the Palestinians of Lebanon that they were no longer safe in that country. Do you agree with that?
I actually don't. I think that the objective of Sharon, who was the defense minister, Ariel Sharon, and of the Begin government, was to destroy the PLO. to destroy the political representation of the Palestinians. They did carry out massacres, which I think were intended to terrify the population. But they did nothing to empty the camps in South Lebanon, which they controlled from very early on in the occupation. So I don't think there's much evidence for that assertion by Haaretz.
Rashid, you wrote that the U.S. Secretary of State, Alexander Haig, gave the green light for the Israeli invasion of Lebanon. What more did the U.S. do with respect to diplomatic cover and weapons and aircraft?
Well, the first thing that he did was in a meeting with Ariel Sharon in May, where Sharon laid out his plan to invade Lebanon, create a puppet regime, destroy and expel the PLO, and eliminate Syrian influence from Lebanon by driving the Syrians out, was to say, fine, go ahead, just find a provocation. So he did give a green light, an overt, explicit approval to all of these objectives of Israel a couple weeks before the invasion. The second thing that the United States did, which is extremely important, was to allow Israel to use, in violation of American law, a variety of weapon systems which were manifestly not being used for defensive purposes. In what way would the siege and bombardment of West Beirut be a defensive purpose? All kinds of American weaponry, from artillery to aircraft to tanks and so on and so forth, were being used. The third thing the United States did, and this was extremely important, was to provide the diplomatic muscle for the achievement of Israel's objectives. Israel actually defeated the Syrian army and pushed the Syrians back. And it occupied southern Lebanon. But to get the PLO out required diplomatic means, and the United States provided those means, completely supporting the Israeli objective of expelling the PLO from Lebanon and completely supporting the Israeli objective of creating a government that would be, I would say, subordinate to Israel and do what Israel wanted. And in all of these efforts, the United States, in some cases, even took the lead. So it was serving an Israeli objective, which the Reagan administration at the time agreed with.
Let's talk about exactly what happened in Sabra and Shatila. Talk about that, please.
Well, what happened very simply was that let me go back just a second, because the PLO, in negotiating a ceasefire during the siege of West Beirut, was under enormous pressure to withdraw. Pressure from the United States and military pressure from Israel, bombardments and so forth. It put forward one main condition, that there be ironclad international guarantees for the safety of the civilian population that would be left behind when they withdrew. That is to say, when the PLO left with all of its military forces and weaponry, they wanted guarantees for the protection of the populations of the refugee camps in particular. They wanted this because in 1976 there had been a terrible massacre at Tal el-Za'atar in the suburbs of Beirut by the Falangists and their allies in the Lebanese forces, by the right-wing fascist party that dominated the Lebanese forces, which was the major right-wing militia at the time. And the PLO wanted to ensure that there be no repeat of this. And the Lebanese politicians, the Prime Minister of Lebanon, Shafiq Wazen, and many others, agreed with this. They did not want to see a massacre take place along the lines of what had happened in 1976. So the United States offered guarantees to the PLO and to the Lebanese government that it would protect these populations. It was with that understanding that the PLO agreed to withdraw, and it was with the understanding that the multinational force, the American, French, Italian troops who were landed, would not just oversee the evacuation of the PLO, but would remain behind to protect the camps. As soon as the PLO had left, at the end of August, the multinational force disappeared because the United States decided it wanted to leave, and the French and the Italians, who had planned to stay longer, said they couldn't stay by themselves. What then happened was that the president-elect of Lebanon, Bashir Ismail, one of the leaders of the Lebanese forces, the number two guy in the Falangist party, was blown up in their headquarters on the 14th of September. And Sharon took this as a pretext to invade West Beirut and to prepare Lebanese forces' militias to be inserted into the camps, which the Israeli army surrounded from the high ground to the west and in every other direction. So you had Israeli tanks surrounding the camps, and you had these militias inserted by Israel, armed, trained, and directed by the Israelis, into the refugee camps, where Sharon and other Israeli leaders claimed there were thousands of armed terrorists. Of course, there were no quote-unquote terrorists. There were no armed fighters. There were just ordinary civilians. And the result was the massacre of at least 1,300 people, both Palestinians and Lebanese, from late on the 16th until the morning of the 18th of September.
I've read that the Israelis lit up the area with flares, and also that there were Israeli soldiers disguised in the camps at the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, I saw the flares. I mean, I was in Beirut at the time. There were. The Israelis fired flares to light the way for these militias that were carrying out these massacres on the night of the 16th to the 17th. I was at the American University of Beirut, and I was a little surprised because the fighting had stopped. The Israeli army had entered West Beirut almost unopposed. There was no resistance. And flares are used to light up a battlefield. Mm. And there was no battle going on, as far as anybody knew. So we were very perplexed, and it was only the following day we found out from journalist friends of ours. That's what the flares that we'd seen had been doing. They'd been lighting up a massacre.
And how many people were killed?
Well, the best account by actually a very good historian indicates that at least 1,300 people, 1,300 people were massacred.
And those are mostly women and children and the
old
elderly.
People. You know, the fighters had gone. Most military-age men were gone. So some men were killed, mainly old men and young and very young children, basically, and teenagers. But mainly women and children, yeah.
In response to a world outcry, Israel set up a commission of inquiry.
Mm-hmm.
And they found Sharon had what they called personal responsibility for the massacre, and they recommended that he be dismissed from his post as defense minister.
Mm-hmm.
What happened?
What happened was that Sharon and every military officer involved, the chief of staff, head of the Northern Command, were all condemned by the Kahan Commission report. That's the name of it. It's a Supreme Court justice headed it. And were all described as responsible for what had happened. Begin was also censured, but not condemned in the same terms.
He was the prime minister.
The prime minister at the time. Sharon did lose his job. All the generals were removed, but nobody really had anything serious happen to them. Yitzhak Shamir, who was the foreign minister and was culpable and involved and in the know, later on became prime minister. Sharon, after a brief period in disgrace, returned to Israeli politics and became prime minister. Every one of the generals ended up serving in some other post later on. So even though the commission did sanction a number of people, condemn a number of people, none of them really suffered any permanent harm. And in fact, it is now known that the commission withheld a lot of evidence that would have made for much more damning conclusions that Israel actually organized, planned, and intended a massacre. They never said that. The evidence actually proves that that was the case, but that evidence was never released. In fact, it is available. It is not publicly available, but it is available. And it was a crucial factor in the lawsuit that Sharon brought against Time magazine, in which he claimed to have been defamed because Time quoted from some of this stuff, but could not use the material because it didn't have the right to use it at the time.
What happened to the lawsuit?
He won. Sharon won. I mean, imagine this. The person who was, according to evidence that couldn't be used, guilty of much more than simply personal responsibility, actually won a libel suit against Time magazine.
I wondered about the CIA's role in all of this. There was a particularly bloodthirsty member of the Lebanese phalangists, the Lebanese fascists, named, I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly, Eli Hobeika.
Hobeika, yes.
Yeah, and it's been alleged that he worked closely with the CIA. Mm-hmm. What do you know about that?
Well, I don't know. The CIA's files are not open now and will probably never be open. So we would have to wait for somebody who worked in the agency to reveal this in a memoir, which he doesn't submit for vetting. We'll never know. It is known that from the 70s, when Henry Kissinger was Secretary of State, the United States, according to diplomatic documents that have been published, by the United States government, was intent on breaking the back, that's the term that Kissinger used, of the PLO in Lebanon, and that the United States extended covert support to a variety of actors. At some stage, the Syrian army is mobilized and goes into action against the PLO in 1976. That was engineered by Kissinger. It is pretty clear that the CIA, Saudi Arabia, and Iran under the Shah also supplied weapons and other assistance to the Lebanese forces. So that the CIA was involved with them is known, But what proof is there? We haven't got much proof. There's not likely to be proof unless somebody decides to, you know, become a whistleblower and tell the truth.
An estimated 17,000 Palestinian and Lebanese persons were killed by Israel in the 1982 bombing and invasion. Tens of thousands were wounded and disabled. Why does the massacre at Sabra and Shatila stand out?
Yeah, that's actually a good question. All over South Lebanon, in particular in Ain al-Helwi camp near Saida, and in other places, there was fearful loss of life. Much of it was in the fighting. In Ain al-Helwi, for example, there was quite a strong resistance to the Israeli advance, and they basically destroyed large parts of the camp, including the civilian population. But it was in a situation where they were actually fighting, and the Israelis were taking casualties. Much of the death and destruction in Beirut, however, took place as a result of indiscriminate bombardments. That's a term I use advisedly because it was used by the New York Times bureau chief at the time, Tom Friedman, in a internal memo that he sent to his editors when they tried to take the word indiscriminate out of one of his dispatches. And he wrote them back saying, I mean, I know they're bombarding all over the year. This was actually published by the Village Voice at the time. They got a hold of the internal memo in the Times system. I'm guessing that it was Friedman himself who leaked it. And so a lot of people were being killed in West Beirut in buildings that were brought down. I mean, there was a building near our house, where we lived, that the Israelis suspected of being a place where Arafat had been seen. And they flattened the building. I mean, it was a 6-8 apartment building, which was occupied by refugees, Palestinians who had fled the camps, which were under bombardment, and taken refuge in safer areas of West Beirut. And because the Israelis suspected that Arafat had been there, they fired what was probably a precision-guided munition that blew out the lower floor of the building, and the whole building pancaked. And scores of people, I don't remember how many people, 100 people, a lot. There were many, many cases like this, both where the Israelis were targeting somebody and cases where they were completely mistaken, where they were just bombarding or hitting buildings indiscriminately. So there was a lot of death and destruction, wanton death and destruction. The difference here in Sabra and Shatila was that everybody knew what the phalangists would do if they were sent into a camp. They had done it before. There were massacres and counter-massacres. There were massacres of Maronite Christians. I mean, one of the things that the Maronites were doing was taking revenge for massacres like the one that took place at Damour in 1975, if I'm not mistaken, when many, 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 you know, innocent civilians were slaughtered, mainly by left-wing militias, Lebanese left-wing militias. So this had been happening on both sides, but the phalangists had done this in a major refugee camp, Tal el-Zaatar, killing hundreds and hundreds of people. So everybody knew what would happen. So sending these people into this camp, which was known to be defenseless, was a particularly wanton act of savagery on the part of the Israeli high command. And they knew what they were doing. This was not, you know, an accident or a mistake. So when they say, when the Kahan Commission said personal responsibility, there was an order given to do this, and it was known what that order would lead to. A lot of this evidence was suppressed by the Kahan Commission. But we know. We have now, in American and Israeli diplomatic documents, encounters between American and Israeli diplomats were Israeli leaders, but in some cases they say, well, we are worried that the phalangists will be a little brutal or a little savage or whatever it may be. Everybody knew. This was not, in any case, a secret.
This is the 35th anniversary of the massacre. Is it getting much attention, not just in the United States, but elsewhere?
It's getting a lot of attention in Lebanon. I actually have an interview tomorrow with a correspondent based in Beirut who's covering the commemorations in Lebanon. It is getting a lot of attention in Lebanon and in the Arab world. I'm actually doing something on the BBC Arabic service about this. So yes, in the Arab world it is getting a lot of attention.
Let me ask you about Lebanon as the country, because prior to 1982 it had a booming economy, and afterwards this was all reversed. Tell what happened to Lebanon as a whole.
Well, Lebanon had a booming economy until the civil war began in 1975. And it began to go downhill at that point. With the Israeli invasion, something quite qualitatively different happened with the invasion of 1982. By inserting itself not only in Lebanese politics through a military intervention, which Israel and Syria and the PLO had all done previously, but by marching to Beirut and installing a friendly government, Israel, with the support, complete and utter support of the United States, let it be said, Israel began this is the first time Israel tried regime change in the Arab world. This is the first time Israel had occupied an Arab capital, besieged and bombarded and later occupied an Arab. It never did that before or after. I mean, it bombed a nuclear reactor in Iraq, it bombed Cairo, it bombed Damascus, but it never marched its army to, besieged and occupied an Arab capital. And never before had this kind of overt regime change taken place. Israeli tanks were there when the Lebanese parliament voted Bashir Ismail as president. And then after he was killed on the 14th, 6-7 days later, they voted his brother, Amin Ismail, in as president. So here was a case where Israel was intervening very directly in Lebanese politics, supporting one side in the internal conflict among Lebanese. And that sent the country into a much more serious spiral very soon afterwards. Things seemed sort of calm. We were in Beirut and stayed until 1983.
You and your brother?
My brother, my kids, my wife, my mother. We all lived in Beirut at the time. After the massacres, an American diplomat evacuated us to. We went to Syria, then we ended up in Cairo, but we came back because my wife wanted to have our youngest son with her doctor. So as soon as the Israelis withdrew from Beirut Airport, I think in October, she went back, and he was born in November. So we lived another year in Beirut after the war. And for a while, it looked like everything was calm, but very clearly, the Israelis and the Americans had pushed the balance of Lebanese politics in one direction. And there was obviously going to be a reaction. And very soon after we left in August, all hell broke loose. The country descended into one of the worst phases of the Civil War. And, you know, the signs that there might be a recovery just disappeared. The country suffered until 1990 from continued bouts of civil war. So there were another 8 years after 82.
Rashid, I wanted to ask you about another lawsuit. This one didn't do that well. General Yaron was assigned after 82. He was assigned to be the military attaché from Israel to the United States.
Right.
And he was sued in the United States by some of the survivors of Sabra and Shatila. And the suit was dismissed on the grounds that he had diplomatic immunity.
Right.
And you followed that. What was your reaction to it?
Yeah, I was actually in Lebanon for most of the suit. I didn't get to the States until it was almost over. I did follow it, though. Well, you know, there were a lot of people who were responsible, and some of whom did not have diplomatic immunity. So if I were advising the lawyers, I would have had them go after someone else who was in a think tank in Washington and who was also removed from his post, another general, found responsible by the Kahan Commission and removed from his post and went to a cushy job at a think tank in Washington. And he did not have diplomatic immunity. In fact, he was living in the same building we were living in when we got there in 1983. It was really a real shock. We saw this guy at the swimming pool and we said, he looks like, you know, he was big, huge guy with military demeanor in a bathing suit, but he looked like a soldier. And somebody later on told us that's I forget his name, General something or other. And that would have been the kind of person to go after, someone who did not have diplomatic immunity. There was nothing you could do to someone who was the military attaché at the Israeli embassy.
At the time of the bombardment and invasion of Lebanon and the Sabra and Shatila slaughter, Menachem Begin was the prime minister of Israel. Ariel Sharon was the defense minister. Yitzhak Shamir was in Israeli politics.
He was actually the foreign minister.
The foreign minister. Mm-hmm. The three had been involved in terrorist activity against Palestinians prior to the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948. Writing prophetically in The Iron Wall, the rightist ideological forebear of Zionism, Vladimir Jabotinsky, coldly assessed the psychology of the native Palestinians. And I'm going to read briefly. They looked upon Palestine with the same instinct of love and true fervor that any Aztec looked upon his Mexico or any Sioux upon his prairie. Each people will struggle against colonizers until the last spark of hope that they can avoid the dangers of conquest and conversation is extinguished. The Palestinians will struggle in this way until there is hardly a spark of hope. This is the argument of the Zionists in support of what they have done to the Palestinians. Your thoughts?
Well, I've always admired Vladimir Jabotinsky for his forthrightness. Other Zionist leaders at the time were lying through their teeth and claiming Zionism won't hurt the Palestinians. Palestinians and concocted a whole series of utterly false arguments about the harmlessness of what Zionism was doing and about how essentially no harm would be done to the Palestinians. Jabotinsky was brutally frank. First of all, in calling Zionism a colonizing movement. Secondly, talking about the indigenous population with a certain degree of respect. And thirdly, understanding that this was a fight to the death. And incidentally, in that you're quoting from an article in which he talked about the Iron Wall. He was talking about an iron wall of British bayonets. At that stage, the Zionist movement couldn't possibly have achieved what it ended up doing without the massive support of British imperialism. And that's what he was arguing in the article from which you quoted a passage. But the other point that you're raising about terrorism, the Lehi and the what's called the Stern Gang, and the Irgun, headed by Begin, Shamir, and others, people who later became prime ministers of the State of Israel, actually specialized in what could only be called terror attacks, that is to say, barrel bombs, car bombs, truck bombs being used against civilian populations in markets. They did this all over Palestine, especially Jaffa and Jerusalem. And they were the acknowledged masters of terrorism against defenseless civilian populations. Long before the British evacuated Palestine, long before the 1948 war broke out, these kinds of actions were being carried out mainly in cities, but also in other places against mainly defenseless civilians. They also attacked the British and are therefore seen as heroes by many Israelis. But their actions against the Palestinians were actually the most significant. And as far as the British were concerned, they were terrorists, mainly because of what they did to the British. But I think that by any standard, if one judges, you know, attacks on unarmed civilians as constituting terrorism, these people were arch terrorists, master terrorists.
And three of them became prime ministers of the State of Israel.
Well, you know, Sharon was in a different category. Sharon carried out massacres, for example, the massacre at Qibya in 1953, as the commander of a military unit called Unit 101, which blew up houses over the heads of civilians. So he carried out massacres of civilians, but it was a different form of massacre and in a different context. He pioneered those kinds of methods within the Israeli army of, you know, use of shock, force, brutality against civilians. So what he ordered and what happened in Sabra and Shatila was in line with his whole career going back to the 50s.
Let's talk about the blowback from the events of 1982, because they're with us in a frightening way today. And I'm thinking particularly of Trump's threats last week at the United Nations, where he mentioned Iran 37 times and said that Iran was spreading terror throughout the Middle East, that they would have nuclear weapons. And, you know, Iran doesn't seem to me to be any threat. In fact, it was the Iranian government that was overthrown by the United States in 1953, not vice versa. Right. Nevertheless, Iran now is the object of this drive towards war by the United States and by Israel. And I wanted to ask you how that all evolved.
Well, a couple things. First of all, this use of the word terror. You know, the Iranian government has supported people who've carried out what I would call acts of terror, which is, say, attacks against unarmed civilians. But we're now talking about a war in 1982, which the United States sanctioned, diplomatically supported, and provided the arms for, in which 17,000 to 19,000 people, mostly civilians, were murdered. That's not terror. You set off a bomb and kill a number of civilians. That would seem to me to be definable as terror. You bring down an apartment building three blocks from my house in August 1982 with an American weapon, and that's not terror? So this is a term which is infinitely malleable and is used only in one sense, by one side, to describe actions that it disapproves of, but is never applied to sometimes even more heinous actions, killing infinitely more civilians by another side. The Israelis are masters at the use of this, but so is the United States. So that's the first thing. The second thing is about the genesis of Hezbollah and its relation to this war. There was no such thing as Hezbollah before the 1982 war. Hezbollah was created by the 1982 war. That's not my conclusion. That's the conclusion of an Israeli general who became chief of staff and later prime minister and defense minister, Ehud Barak. He said, we created Hezbollah. By our invasion of Lebanon, we created Hezbollah. Israeli general, prime minister saying something which I agree with. Hezbollah was created as a result of multiple factors in Lebanon. And there were multiple actors that supported the creation of Hezbollah. One of them was Iran. The Iranians had sent Revolutionary Guards to Lebanon via Syria during the Israeli invasion in 1982, and they helped to create Hezbollah. But there were other important factors involved. Another was an Iraqi revolutionary Shia underground movement called Ad-Dawah, which in fact has provided most of the prime ministers put on into their chairs by the United States since the American occupation of Iraq in 2003. That's the ruling party in Iraq and has been for many, many years. It first came to public attention by blowing up the Iraqi embassy with a truck bomb in 1979, 81, I forget the year. I remember it vividly. I was living in Beirut at the time. The whole city shook. It was one of the first uses of a truck bomb, a suicide truck bomb. And Ad-Dawah was very powerful opponent of the Saddam Hussein regime, supported by Iran, but an independent Iraqi underground revolutionary movement using these terrorist means. They were a major influence on the people who later became Hezbollah, as were the Palestinians. Many of the fighters who supported the Palestinians before and during the 1982 war were young Lebanese, mainly from the south and the north of Lebanon, mainly Shiites. There were Christians and Muslims and Druze, and every sect in Lebanon supported the Palestinians, and many of them fought with the Palestinians. But a very large proportion were young teenagers, high school students, university students, and others from the south of Lebanon, the area that had been most harmed by Israel's constant incursions over many years, going back to the 1960s. These people had been very deeply supportive of the Palestinians and opposed to Israel's attacks on Lebanon. When the PLO left, many of them joined Hezbollah. And they were deeply affected by the massacres because we sometimes forget the people, the massacres of Sabra and Shatila, we often forget the camps didn't only contain Palestinians. They also contained lots of poor Lebanese, mainly refugees from the south of Lebanon. And the people slaughtered included a very high proportion of Lebanese. So these people, these young people who had fought with the Palestinians, who had been left behind when the PLO left, PLO was evacuated, had hoped that these families would be protected by the American guarantees that had been offered in return for PLO evacuation. And so they considered the United States to be responsible, as well as Israel. And so Hezbollah's attacks on Israeli military headquarters in Tyre was blown up twice by the people who later become Hezbollah. We remember the Marine barracks bombing. We remember the U.S. embassy bombing. Actually, the embassy was attacked twice, the famous one in which the building on the Corniche on the seafront was destroyed, but they carried out another attack later on. We remember the attack on the French contingent in Beirut. They were attacking the Israelis as well, because as far as they were concerned, these are the people who had destroyed Beirut, killed almost 20,000 Lebanese and Palestinians, and were supported by the United States, which had offered guarantees that proved worthless. So Hezbollah is created not just by the Israeli invasion. Hezbollah is created in response, in some measure, to the American betrayal of its promises to protect the civilian population.
So explain to our audience, please, Rashid, the connection between Hezbollah and Iran.
Mm-hmm. Hezbollah, from its very inception, was led by people who accept the theory put forward by Ayatollah Khomeini of Vilayat al-Faqih, which is the rulership by or rule by clerics. This is a novel theory in Shia theology. It never really was put forward in this way. The idea existed, but it never really meant rule by clerics. Hezbollah accepts this. So when people say that Hezbollah Hezbollah's leadership accepts this. When people say Hezbollah is closely aligned with Iran, this is true on multiple levels. It's not just that Iran helped to create Hezbollah, or Hezbollah is closely aligned with and carries out sometimes the bidding of Iran. It's also that Hezbollah, unlike most other Shiites, unlike many Shia leaders in Lebanon, many Shia leaders in Iraq who don't accept this theory, it does accept the theory. So leadership should be by clerics and therefore by Iranian clerics. And so the supreme guide of the Iranian revolution, first Khomeini and now Khamenei, as far as they're concerned, is their spiritual guide. And this has led to a sort of split among Lebanese Shia. Many of them don't accept this. The great Muhammad Hussein Fadlallah, the great Shiite cleric in Lebanon, never accepted this theory. Ali Sistani, the most important ayatollah in Iraq, he doesn't accept this theory. They do not accept they do not accept Iranian leadership. They do not accept the spiritual guidance of the supreme guide, unlike Hezbollah, which does.
This is really fundamental because it brings us to current politics.
Mm-hmm.
And the animosity that both Israel and the United States have against Iran. What's your understanding of that and your feeling for what might happen?
Right. Well, the first thing to say is that, as you pointed out earlier, Iran poses almost no threat to the United States itself. Doesn't have nuclear weapons. The joint agreement prevents it from obtaining nuclear weapons. It doesn't have delivery systems to reach the United States. Iran has problems with its neighbors, and some of those neighbors are U.S. allies, but this does not rise to the level of an existential threat. However, Iran is inflated and inflated and inflated into a world-class bogeyman, and has been by hawks in both parties, by what I call the permanent war party in the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, currently represented by President Trump, but which was, you know, represented by various other leading figures in both parties. Iran is a country that has posed problems for the United States, but there are various ways of regulating these problems. I mean, one of the few things that President Obama did that I agreed with was trying to come to terms with Iran over its nuclear program. I think that was a sane, sensible step to take. I hope that it won't be dismantled by the current administration, the agreement, the nuclear agreement. Unfortunately, there are those, both Israeli and American leaders, who seem to think that a war with Iran is a good idea. There are, however, people who are in positions of responsibility who understand that it is an absolutely insane idea. That would include, I would argue, almost every military, senior military official, not only in the U.S. military, but in the Israeli military. They understand that attacking Iran is a losing proposition. This is a country which has all kinds of natural defenses. It's a very hard country to conquer. It has mountains. It has deserts. It has multiple cities that are hard to, that are far away from one another. It has a very robust military. It has a very robust capacity for power projection and for self-defense. It can make an attacker pay an enormous price. And, I mean, military people I've talked to have said that invading Iran would make Iraq, the Iraqi war, look like a cakewalk. It is an extraordinarily difficult country to conquer, or would be for the United States or for Israel. So one only can hope that even though there are people who might want to drag us into an overt conflict with Iran, an armed conflict, a war, that saner heads will prevail. It's easy to start a war. It's very hard to determine how a war is going to go once you start it. I think the awful experiences of Afghanistan since 2001 and of Iraq since 2003 are illustrations of that.
Rashid, before we come to the end of our allotted time, your final thoughts on the meaning of Sabra and Shatila on this, the 35th anniversary.
The role of the United States and the responsibility of the United States for what happened, I think, have never been fully explored. It's very easy to see what the Falangists did. And many of the leaders of the Falangist Party, actually, some of them were assassinated, some of them spent time in jail. It's not like they were punished for Sabra and Shatila, but there's a recognition of their role. There's a recognition of the Israeli role. I mean, there's a huge revulsion inside Israel after these massacres. Begin ultimately had to leave office. He wasn't condemned by the Kahan Commission in the same way as Sharon was, and he wasn't deprived of his job, but he had to leave office. So even though later on Shamir became prime minister, he was foreign minister and was responsible at the time of Sabra and Shatila, even though Sharon later became prime minister, in Israel, there was some sense of Israel having been involved in something awful. I don't think this country ever recognized its full responsibility. what President Reagan, Secretary Haig, Secretary Shultz, the various diplomats involved in the negotiations, in the support for Israel's war on Lebanon. I don't think there has been a recognition that this was the first of a series of disastrous interventions in the Middle East, the blowback for which we are still paying for today. The hostility that we created then is still around. Hezbollah and Iran are, to some extent, I mean, there are problems between the United States and Iran that transcend anything that happened in Lebanon. But Lebanon exacerbated all those problems, created a new problem in the form of Hezbollah, and is yet another example of American bias in the conflict between the Palestinians and Israel. Palestinians don't forget, and people in the Arab world won't forget. I mean, as the commemorations go on this week, people all over the Arab world are going to be reminded not just of what the Falangists or Israel did, but what the United States did. And there has to be a reckoning for that in this country.
Rashid, it's always a privilege to have you on, especially this week, and we hope to stay in touch.
Thank you.
Rashid Khalidi, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Heidi.
Bye-bye. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. The Queensbridge House Public Housing Project in Long Island City, Queens, is the largest such complex in the country. With more than 7,000 residents, it's a community with little faith in civic engagement. Like other public housing communities and low-income neighborhoods in general, poor people vote at considerably lower rates than wealthier ones. Many feel apathetic, that the system is rigged, and that their votes just don't matter. One nonprofit in New York City is using innovative partnerships with community-based social service organizations to conduct nonpartisan voter mobilization so that more underrepresented citizens can participate in our democracy. Community Votes is trying to change the culture and the mindset of large nonprofit social service agencies so that they integrate into their day-to-day operations civic engagement activities. Such activities include promoting awareness of elections and issues and encouraging voting and other participation in federal, state, and city policymaking. A few years ago, Community Votes partnered with the Jacob Riis Neighborhood Settlement, a longtime provider of social services in the Queensbridge houses, to engage in personalized messaging to mobilize voters there. The results were a considerably higher rate of voter turnout in the 2014 midterm elections. Joining us to talk about these initiatives is Louisa Hackett, the founder and executive director of Community Votes. Louisa, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Louisa, years ago, I think it was nearly 30 years, you and I worked together at the Community Service Society, providing technical assistance to grassroots organizations in New York City. How did you come to form Community Votes?
Heidi, after I left Community Service Society, I went to work for over 20 years with the Community Resource Exchange, also known as CRE. And there I was working one-on-one with hundreds of community-based organizations. And after the crash in the about 8 years ago, most of my work had to do with strategic planning. And all the groups were struggling with figuring out how to serve more people facing greater needs with less resources because there was less government money, less foundation money, less individual donations. And all of these organizations worked in low-income communities. And I wondered how the world or their worlds might be different if these same communities had high voter turnout because all of them didn't. And I then heard of an organization called Nonprofit Vote, which supports this work nationally. And their premise was work with community-based organizations to help increase voter turnout. And I thought that made a lot of sense. So I tried it out in the city and we did our first project with Jacob Riis Neighborhood Settlement House, and it's been expanded since.
So talk a bit, if you will, about the model that you use, because as you say, you involve nonprofit organizations that are already doing community work. Is it okay for them to bring this component into their work? Does it take them away from their mission, for example?
No. In fact, when I had the idea of bringing this work to the city, I interviewed 30 nonprofit leaders, and all of them understood that this would be really a way for them to better achieve their mission, to do more than just deliver services, to actually help empower the people they serve to get involved in policymaking. So it actually is very mission-aligned.
And tell us how it works. So you have several groups that you work with, and then what do they do?
So I help them identify people within their organizations that are interested in doing this work. I then work with them to identify opportunities where they already interact with the public. So whether it's in waiting rooms, whether it's at their community picnics, whether it's at their parent orientations. Then I train a cohort of staff on how to do nonpartisan voter registration and get out the vote activities. We practice convincing people to talk about why voting is important. We arm them with voter education material so they can answer particular questions about policy issues. And then the staff themselves go out and do the work. The reason the model works is because voter research says really the single most effective way to convince someone to vote is a one-on-one conversation. And nonprofits have thousands and thousands of these conversations a year. They're trusted because they're in the community year in and year out.
Mm, the old-fashioned.
I know. No app.
No app. We're concerned about, and we mentioned this in the introduction, and I've read about it in articles, is that in low-income communities around the nation, including New York, there's a lot of voter apathy, that people feel the system can't change, they can't make a difference. Are your cadres of people sort of instructed on what to say about that, or do you need sort of a pep talk? How do you change that mentality?
Well, it's not easy. First, you can't deny it. You have to find out what people think about it, and if, in fact, they're cynical, you find out why, and you find out what they care about, then you loop back into if they care about stop and frisk, or if they care about dangerous streets, or if they care about lack of public parks, you then connect to say, well, your local elected officials have discretion over budget dollars, which decide this. Your local mayor hires the police commissioner, which affects what the stop and frisk policies might be. So we find out something that they're interested in and then connect it back to the decisions politicians make.
One thing I was wondering about is in the media, we've heard a lot about allegations that there might be hackers disrupting the elections. Does that kind of thing further erode confidence, in your opinion? Have you seen that?
I haven't seen it yet, but I don't doubt that it will. I think what further erodes sort of cynicism is the lack of competitive elections. So in New York City, for example, in this primary, which we just had on September 12th, the reason we focused on the primary is because that's in a deep blue city. That's where the decision is made. And there were actually only about 10 open city council seats this primary. So we tried to focus on those neighborhoods where there was a competitive election, because come November, it will really have already been decided in terms of those elected positions. That being said, there are a couple ballot questions on the ballot in November, which I think we can draw people to the polls to vote on.
Do you think, Louisa, that people are more cynical about national elections? Do you think you can persuade them that they have more of a say-so in local elections?
Well, that's what we're trying to do. The conundrum is national elections get much more press and attention, and so more people are talking about it, and less people are talking about local elections. But when people say their vote doesn't count, when you bring it down to the local election, and particularly a primary election where turnout is so low, increasing turnout by a little bit can make a big difference. So we're trying to make that argument.
Although you could argue that this last national election was an exception with Trump and somebody who was perceived to be a decent guy like Bernie Sanders. But could you argue that that at a local level, if it's a Tweedledum and Tweedledee situation nationally, it could be different at a local level, and you could start changing things from the ground up?
Yes, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I think what's really important is helping people really understand the decision-making power that local officials have, both at the city level and at the state level. And so we've got this most recent election here in the city, 2017, and then we've got the local midterm elections, which will affect who's being elected to go represent them in Albany. So there are many, many opportunities to do that. So the question for the community-based groups is making sure they have enough knowledge to be able to bring that perspective to their participants and the communities that they serve.
Can you quantify the situation? About what percentage of low-income poor people actually do vote in local elections?
Well, I don't know that I can do it just by low income. I know in the local elections, turnout is like in the 20%. And if you go look in particular neighborhoods like the South Bronx or different neighborhoods in Brooklyn, it can be even in the 14%. What's interesting is that voter registration rates are actually pretty high. So, for example, in Queensbridge and Ravenswood, where Jacob Riis works, the registration rates are like 72%. So we quickly, immediately recognize that getting people registered is important. People don't often understand if they haven't voted in 5 years, they're dropped from the rolls. If they change their address, they're dropped from the rolls. Many people don't realize if they've been completed parole, they are able to vote. So this basic information the community groups share, but they quickly realize that we need to focus on voter turnout, because turnout in those, while registration's in the 70s, turnout's in the 20s. So there's this big gap that we're trying to bridge.
And how do you do that? That's a huge gap.
It is a huge gap. So we do it because when they're doing the voter work, they often run into somebody who's registered to vote. So we have them sign an I Pledge to Vote card. These cards have proven in research to increase turnout. So they sign their name and address. The community group then can mail them a reminder card. We also have done two rounds of phone banking. So the New York Civic Engagement Table, who's our critical partner, does training on how to do phone banking. They train the community groups, and they've done two different rounds of phone calls to remind people to vote, as well as posting it on their website and flyers in their lobby.
Louisa, do you have any success stories that you can share, like about an older person or a young person who had no intention of voting but who really did a turnaround?
Well, I can share two, if that's okay. So the first one has to do with the Jacob Riis Neighborhood Settlement House, who I've mentioned before. Their point person working with community votes was Gwendolyn Wilson, who works at the Senior Center. And as we were trying to figure out who to train to do this work, their executive director said, why don't we focus on seniors? They have time. So Gwendolyn now, over two campaign cycles, has a cohort of senior citizens who are going to do door knocking to get out the vote. They've already done the phone banking to remind people to vote. And this segues into my other story.
How old is Gwendolyn, by the way?
Gwendolyn's in her 50s.
Okay.
I hope that's okay, Gwendolyn.
It's not that senior.
Shared.
Okay.
No, but the people she's working with are in their 80s.
Right. Okay. 80s.
They're in their 70s and 80s. But we organized a get out the vote party with some seniors and some high school students. And Mr. Smith, who is in his late 80s, arrived at this party, and he parked his walker outside the door and sat down. And Ms. Maud came. She was the second senior. And Ms. Maud had so engaged the young women. She was high school students. She was explaining that her parents were too scared to vote in the South. And since she moved to New York when she was 20, she hasn't missed one election. And I wanted the young men who were talking to Mr. Smith to switch and talk to Ms. Maud, but the young men were like, I want to hear Mr. Smith. Mr. Smith was saying, I'm old now, this is your time, you need to take over this work. And you know, and he asked them what if they knew what the NAACP was. Sadly, they didn't. He then quoted the JFK quote, don't ask what you can do for your country or what your country can do for you. but what you can do for your country. And the young man who was eligible to vote right then and there asked to be registered.
Nice.
So it's just an example of the model is using the assets within the community. It's not volunteers coming
right.
in. It's using the staff and the participants to convince their community members to vote because they have the best.
And that feels really good when you're involved in that.
Yes.
I know.
Yes.
Changing minds, opening eyes.
Do you ever talk with people about the history of expanding the franchise, securing the right to vote for people who don't own property, or for women, or for black people during the civil rights movement? Because it's so inspiring and so dismaying to see that there have been all these heroic struggles, yet people don't take advantage of them.
Yes, we in our trainings use a 6-minute video from Rock the Vote called The History of Voting that anybody can get on YouTube, and it's an animated history of the struggle for the right to vote back from the colonial days through slavery, through women, through youth, and it does and it's interspersed with celebrities, mm-hmm. and it does the best job, I think, in such a short amount of time to explain.
What's it called again? I want to look it up.
It's called The History of Voting, and it's by Rock the Vote.
Nice. We have just a few minutes left, Louisa. Any plans for expansion or next steps?
Yes. I have been working with umbrella membership organizations of nonprofit organizations. So right now I'm in a partnership with United Neighborhood Houses. They work with 38 organizations throughout the city who in turn reach 750,000 people. So I'm working with their staff so they in turn can support their members. And I have plans to reach additional umbrella organizations in affordable housing, emergency food services, health services. So that's our expansion plan.
Excellent, an ambitious plan.
Yes.
Great. How can listeners learn more about your work?
We have a website, communityvotes.org. There is information there that people can
And can yep. people volunteer if they're interested in
yes,
helping?
Yes, absolutely.
Even if they're not associated with a nonprofit?
Yes.
Repeat that website once more, please.
It's communityvotes.org.
Louisa, on a personal note, if you don't mind sharing, how did you get interested in social justice work?
So probably by osmosis. My father worked in the Kennedy administration, and there was probably many, many conversations around the dinner table about many issues. I do remember him sitting me down in middle school and saying there's two government organizations you need to worry about. That's the FBI and the CIA. And I'm like, what is he talking about? So I had to go look that up. We also were a household that had the Washington Post delivered in the morning and the Evening Star in the evening. And when the Evening Star went out of business, my father said, this is a very sad day because we need to have competition in the news business. It's a good thing. So from my dad, I would say directly.
I think he'd be very proud of you for this,
thank
Louisa.
Thank you, Heidi.
We wish you the best of luck, and we hope to check in after the next round of elections and see how things are going.
Great. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah. Thanks so much for being on Law and Disorder, Louisa. Really appreciate your coming down.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.